This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Colson Whitehead landed on the cover of Time magazine last month next to a caption that called him America's storyteller. He's earned that honor over the course of seven novels that have ranged from wry speculative fiction to zombie apocalypse to sobering historical fiction, all of them in various ways considering the topic of race in America. His 2016 novel, The Underground Railroad, is being adapted into an Amazon TV series directed by Barry Jenkins, who directed Moonlight and If Beale Street Could Talk. Whitehead's new novel is called The Nickel Boys. He's going to talk with us about it, but first, our book critic Maureen Corrigan has this review. She says it's his best novel yet.
It's pretty rare for a writer to produce a novel that wins the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award, and then, a scant 3 years later, bring out another novel that's even more extraordinary. But that's what Colson Whitehead has done in following up his 2016 novel, The Underground Railroad, with The Nickel Boys. It's a masterpiece squared, rooted in history and American mythology, and yet painfully topical in its visions of justice and mercy erratically denied. By Whitehead's own admission, the disturbing true story that informs The Nickel Boys derailed him from the crime novel he'd been planning to write. A few years ago, Whitehead read news reports about the Arthur G. Dozier School for Boys, a segregated reform school in Florida that opened in 1900 and was finally shut down in 2011. Unmarked graves of boys, brutalized and even possibly murdered at the school, were discovered and are still being discovered by forensic archaeologists. In Whitehead's novel, the Dozier School is renamed the Nickel Academy, and it's at this house of horrors that his main character, an African-American teenager named Elwood Curtis, winds up. It's the early 1960s, and Elwood has been listening to a record album of Martin Luther King's speeches that his grandmother gave him for Christmas. Elwood has absorbed Dr. King's message that he must walk the streets of life every day with a sense of dignity and somebodiness. The other kids in high school think he's a goody-goody, but industrious Elwood believes in the meritocracy, and in fact, he's already been offered an opportunity to take classes at a colored college miles away from his home in Tallahassee. To get there, he has to hitchhike. That's when fate steps in the form of a black man driving a bright green Plymouth Fury, which turns out to be stolen. Even though Elwood is but a clueless passenger, he's sent to the Nickel Academy for car theft. Whitehead's novel is short and intense, its chapters as compact as the isolation cells that nickel boys are thrown into and sometimes never leave. One way that Whitehead uses the narrative spareness of the Nickel Boys to devastating effect is by tightly juxtaposing scenes and images and letting the contrast silently sink in. For instance, Elwood's arrival in handcuffs at the Nickel Academy is made all the more wretched by the fact that the school, all green lawns and red brick, looks like his intended college, at least on the outside. And a shattering chapter about a rigged and vicious boxing match that nods to Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man is followed by a description of the annual Christmas fair at the Nickel Academy. The child-friendly displays of Santa and gingerbread houses are constructed by the forced labor of the Nickel Boys, boys who, years later, we're told, could have been so many things had they not been ruined by that place. Doctors who cure diseases or perform brain surgery. Sure, not all of them were geniuses, but they had been denied even the simple pleasure of being ordinary. Hobbled and handicapped before the race even began, never figuring out how to be normal. At Nickel, Elwood makes a friend whose name is Turner. Turner is an expert whistler, often breaking into the theme music from the Andy Griffith Show, another disorienting juxtaposition. He's also more skeptical, especially about the civil rights movement and the chances of justice within the walls of Nickel or beyond. Turner goes along to get along, and as Elwood begins to do the same, he feels his spirit dying. We're told that Elwood wakes up at night and realizes that, in keeping his head down, he fooled himself that he had prevailed. In fact, he had been ruined. He was like one of those Negroes Dr. King spoke of in his letter from Birmingham jail, so complacent and sleepy after years of oppression that they had adjusted to it and learned to sleep in it as their only bed. Before he gives up, Elwood resolves he'll make one last gesture of faith in the possibility that someone in power cares about correcting injustice. You may think you can guess how that effort ends, but you'd only be partially right. The Nickel Boys issues a complex and deeply affecting verdict on whether or not the arc of the moral universe does indeed bend toward justice. But my verdict, so to speak, on the Nickel Boys is much more straightforward. It's a great American novel.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Colson Whitehead's new novel, The Nickel Boys. And if that enthusiastic review got you interested in the novel, stick around, because we're going to hear from the author. I recorded this interview with Colson Whitehead last month. Colson Whitehead, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's good to have you, and the book is remarkable. I thought we would begin with a reading. I mean, your book is about some students at this thing that's called the Trevor Nickel Academy. That's the Nickel Boys is the book, but it's based on the story of the Dozier School in the panhandle of Florida, which is now closed and where many abuses were discovered. This is a reading about a group of ex-students, right? Just to set it up for us.
Sure. It's about 2014, and the school's been closed for a couple years. And people who'd been there in the 50s and 60s and 70s have started a survivors group, and they meet once a year and check out their old haunted place. The annual reunion, now in its fifth year, was strange and necessary. The boys were old men now, with wives and ex-wives, and children they did or didn't talk to, with wary grandchildren who were brought around sometimes, and those whom they were prevented from seeing. They had managed to scrape up a life after leaving Nickel, or had never fit in at all with normal people. The last smokers of cigarette brands you never see, late to the self-help regimens, always on the verge of disappearing. Dead in prison, or decomposing in rooms they rented by the week, frozen to death in the woods after drinking turpentine. The men met in the conference room of the Eleanor Garden Inn to catch up before caravanning out to Nickel for the solemn tour. Some years you felt strong enough to head down that cement walkway, knowing that it led to one of your bad places, and some years you didn't. Avoid a building, or stared in the face, depending on your reserves that morning.
And that is Colson Whitehead reading from his new book, The Nickel Boys. This school really changed people's lives, didn't it?
For some people, it was a very traumatic place. Not everyone who went through Dozier ended up being abused. There are 600 students going through it each year, and that would be a tragedy on a catastrophic scale. But it's 110 years of existence. There were many stories of sexual abuse, physical abuse, and even murder. They found some unmarked graves on the grounds, and that's when the sort of investigation of what actually happened at Dozier happened.
Now, your last book, The Underground Railroad, which won the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize, was a look at slavery. What made you want to write about Dozier, about this school?
I didn't want to. I felt sort of compelled to. I came across a story of the school in 2014. They wanted to sell the property, the state of Florida did, and they started exhuming the official graveyard. And then they found a lot of unmarked graves, and some archaeology students started excavating the unmarked graves and trying to ID different students who'd been there. And the story stayed with me. If there's one place like this, there are many places, and maybe it's a reform school, it's an orphanage. Talking to some folks in Canada, they talked about residential schools there where indigenous kids were taken from their families and put in schools to learn about white culture. And the same kind of abuse happened. And it seemed, if the story hadn't been told, someone needed to tell it.
And how did you research the subject? Did you go down and visit Dozier?
Well, I was on Twitter, where I often am. That's where I first came across the news report. And then immediately started, you know, searching. And Ben Montgomery from the Tampa Bay Times had covered the story for years. So there's a lot of Florida coverage, not a lot of national coverage. When I started writing, there's some memoirs. There's a survivor site called the White House Boys. And people who'd been there in the 50s and 60s had written down some of their stories of being there. And then online there are a lot of photo archives, and you can see the White House where the kids were beaten. You can see the dormitories and the administration buildings. And it all looks very nice. It's a very beautiful campus. And then once you hear about it, you know, your idea about it definitely changes.
But you didn't feel the need to go there, huh?
I intended to go. I like doing research. Whenever I travel for a book, I always feel like I'm earning like a real writer badge or something. And I figured I'd go down there after I got halfway through the book. And then the deeper I got in and the more I wrote about Elwood and Turner, my two main characters, the more I had a sense of real physical dread and anger thinking about the place. And then I realized I was not going to go. And if I was going to go, it would be with some dynamite or a bulldozer. I think it's an evil place, and I'm not sure if I'll ever go there.
So how did you get the texture of the place to write about it?
You know, I'm not a zombie hunter or a runaway slave or an elevator inspector.
Okay.
Generally, I enjoy
things you have written about.
In other books, and I do enough research to feel grounded and really eager to start working, and that's when I know I have enough to keep going. And then, like any writer, fiction writer, you know, I use my empathy and imagination, what I know about myself and other people, to make it real.
So, the young man who is at the heart of our story, Elwood. Isn't a kid who has come from an abusive home. Do you want to just talk about this character and why he's the kind of kid you wanted to let take us into this school?
Sure. His name is Elwood Curtis. He's a straight-A student being raised by his grandparents. You know, has a job after school working in a tobacco store, wants to go to college. And he's grown up idolizing Martin Luther King and all the lights of the civil rights movement. He reads Life magazine every week and sees the updates on the boycotts and protests and sit-ins and sees himself as a part of this new generation that's going to change America, you know, bit by bit.
And we should just note, this: he's in Tallahassee, Florida, in the Jim Crow South, in this late 50s, early 60s, right?
The book opens in the 50s. The main action is in 63. Mm-hmm. And so he's actually lived in an era where things actually are moving slowly forward. He hitches a ride with the wrong person. It's a stolen car and gets sent to Nickel. And for me, it's a way in for my experience. I've been stopped by police for no reason. I've been handcuffed and interrogated. I think most young people of color have been stopped by police in this way. And he makes a wrong turn, and he's in the wrong place at the wrong time. And I think for many people of color, we can relate to suddenly having your life, being able to change at any second.
So what happened when you were pulled over in handcuffs? What happened?
I was, junior in high school, and I was with some friends. We were in a supermarket, and suddenly there was a white cop saying, "Put your hands behind you." He put handcuffs on me, took me out to the street to his squad car, where there was a white woman in the back seat. She'd been mugged. And I guess I was the first black teenager they came across. And luckily, she said that I was not the person who mugged her. And I happened to just be minding my own business. And like many young people of color, you know, if I had shifted the wrong way, reached for my wallet the wrong way, you know, who knows what could have happened. And so that informs my idea of being in the world and how any second things can go awry. And I know I'm not alone in understanding that sort of menacing reality is always waiting there.
Right, right. Or you could be misidentified by somebody.
Misidentified, and, you know, if she hadn't been in the backseat, would I have spent the night in the Tombs, the local New York jail? And once I'm there, who knows whether my life goes this way or that way. So that, you know, that opportunity for tragedy is always there, I think, when it comes for people between people of color and white law enforcement. And that's sort of our reality.
So Elmwood, this optimistic young man, ends up in this reform school because he hitches a ride with a guy who happens to have stolen a car. He gets convicted of car theft, and he's in this place. How do his values mesh with the experience that confronts him?
Well, you know, he's not there very long before he discovers that despite its beautiful exterior, things are quite off. He breaks up a fight between some big kids and a little kid, and his real initiation into the school is being taken to the White House. At the real Dozier School, it was called the White House. It was a utility shed on campus that he started using for beatings after a short-lived reform. Corporal punishment was outlawed, and so they took the boys in real life to this place called the White House, and it was too great a detail to change, and the name, that is. And the kids on campus at Dozier called it the ice cream factory because you came out with different bruises of every color. And so he breaks up this fight, and nobody is really particularly concerned about who started it, who's trying to break it up. The guilty and innocent are punished equally, and that's an early lesson at Nickel Academy.
You know, I thought we would listen to a piece of tape from an NPR report. This is from 2012, a reporter named Greg Allen, and it's based on his conversation with a guy who survived Dozier named Jerry Cooper and what happened when he had committed some offense and was taken to the White House for some discipline. Let's listen.
School staff got him out of bed at 2 a.m. one morning and took him to the White House, where he says they threw him on a bed, tied his feet, and began beating him with a leather strap.
The first blow lifted me a foot and a half off that bed. And every time that strap would come down, you could hear the shuffle on the concrete because their shoes would slide. And, you know, you could hear the shoop, shoop, bam.
Cooper passed out, but a boy in the next room later told him he counted 135 lashes.
And that's from a report from NPR reporter Greg Allen about abuses at the Dozier School. The story has inspired the novel by our guest Colson Whitehead. It's called The Nickel Boys. That really is the way it happened, isn't it?
Yeah, no, the same details came up in a lot of different accounts. To muffle the sounds of the beatings and the screams, they had this huge industrial fan. And so if you heard the fan go on the other side of campus, you knew what was happening. And that came up a lot. The sound of the leather strap hitting the ceiling before it came down upon your back was repeated a lot. And I talked to one man who said that when you heard the belt hit the ceiling, you knew to tense up to, you know, sort of diminish the blow. And so all those tiny details have stayed with the people, you know, for decades and decades, and they can still hear it and still feel it and hear it and in their very bones.
Right. And what would it do to a student's back to get 100 of those kinds of lashes delivered with that kind of force?
Sure. It breaks it open. And then another thing that came up a lot was the kids being beaten across the leg so much that their fibers of their jeans are embedded in their skin. I'm being grisly. And then the doctor in the infirmary having to take tweezers and pluck them out. And, you know, more than one person related that detail. And so you see it's a bit of a factory, unfortunately.
So a lot of kids were beaten, and there are a lot of stories about this. Do we believe that kids were murdered?
Well, there are kids in unmarked graves with blunt trauma to their skulls and gunshot pellets in their rib cages. And so how they get there? Teenagers buried in the ground with great evidence of violence. They didn't, you know, faint.
Right, or get the flu.
Or get the flu.
We should note that no one has been criminally accused of of killing anybody there. Of course, a lot of this happened decades ago, and so the evidence isn't easy to acquire, and some of the perpetrators are now deceased. In the last part of the book, we meet some of the characters later in life, and I don't want to say more than that about it because it would spoil it for readers, and they deserve to experience this. But I have to say the narrative structure here of how the course of their lives is revealed, I think is pretty brilliant. And I wonder if you can, without giving away the story, just talk a little bit about how you decide to reveal the outcomes.
Yeah. I mean, the majority of the book takes place in 63 and 64, and then we follow Elwood as he grows up and gets out of the Nickel Academy and moves to New York. And we see him in the 70s, and we see him in the 80s, the early part of this century. And so we see what sort of makes him as a man, and then we see the after effects of it. How do you come back from something as traumatic as being at Nickel? Who makes a whole life decades later, and who is perpetually victimized by their time there? Do you become addicted to drugs, an alcoholic? Can you find someone to love, make a family, keep a job? It's a few months out of his life, Elwood's young life, and then he has to spend the next couple of decades finding his way in the world. And I think whether you were in a place like Dozier, if you had a family catastrophe early on, any sort of disaster you bounce back from, you reckon with it. It changes you, and then it changes your world. And so that's where we find Elwood in his later chapters, is a man trying to find himself after this very formative few months.
You know, the book is a lot about the struggle between optimism about social change and kind of a pragmatic acceptance of the world as it is. And we're in some pretty turbulent times in this country these days. How optimistic are you for positive change?
I find I feel better if I don't think about it. I don't know. This book comes out of, feeling very desperate, feeling that, in the last 60 years, we have made some toddler steps towards equality. And then, we fall back. And that's been my sort of experience my whole life. We sort of make an advance and then we go back two spaces. And, my parents were basically Elwood's generation. And I can't imagine my grandparents or my parents raising their kids in a racist country and then seeing what has happened in the last 50 years. We had a black president. That's crazy. And then I think they'd be not surprised about swastikas being painted on synagogues and incarceration camps full of brown people at the border. So I guess my new line on hope is that I don't see a lot changing in my lifetime. I think hopefully my kids, 50 years from now, will have a different idea, the same way that I have a different idea than my parents and grandparents. But right now, I think we're pretty stuck, and I don't see things getting a lot better before they get worse.
How old are your kids?
5 and 14.
Okay. So the older one especially is in a position to be aware of a lot of things.
And she's like super woke. She's like policing me on my super PC-ness, which is sort of startling. And then the younger one, I hope to start training early. He's into cops and robbers. And so he raises an eyebrow and he'll say, a police car will speed by and he'll say, there's a cop going to stop a robber, and I'll have to step in and say, or an innocent person driving a car that the cop thinks is too fancy for him in the wrong neighborhood. That's the sort of early tutelage you get in the Whitehead household.
Well, while you were writing this book, I'm wondering, what was happening in the country on race relations? I mean, a lot's happened in the last few years. I'm wondering what events might have informed your thinking as you were writing this.
What made that first news report about Dozier indelible was the fact that it was the summer of 2014. And that was the summer Michael Brown was shot by a white policeman in Ferguson, Missouri. Eric Garner put in a chokehold by white policemen in Staten Island. And it's been a feature of my life that, you know, we had these high-profile police brutality incidents. We talk about police brutality for a few months and then stop until the next time it comes along. So that summer was so, you know, the fact that no one's ever held accountable, no one ever goes to jail, no one ever takes any responsibility made me feel very raw. And I think that allowed the story of Dozier to sort of settle in me. It was another example of just people who are powerless, people who have no defenses, being abused by an institution, and the guilty go free and the innocent suffer.
This is your ninth book, and your last one, The Underground Railroad, won a National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize, selected by Oprah Winfrey, which I'm sure boosted sales a lot and gave it a much bigger profile. As you finished and published this book, did it feel like a completely different experience because of where your career is?
Not so much because of the success of The Underground Railroad. You know, it seemed like a once-in-a-lifetime kind of convergence of me doing what I set out to do and other people getting it. And it was quite lovely. But, you know, nine books in, you know, I've had books that, let's say, people didn't appreciate or underappreciated, and books that people sort of got. And then whether it goes well or crappily the last time, you always have to start with the blank page. And, you know, I switch genres a lot, and I'm always trying to figure out different ways of telling stories. And so that challenge is always there. I'm writing a short, realistic book about something that actually happened. This book is fantastic. This book is a nonfiction book about poker. And so I was in a good mood for a year, and then you get back to work, and it's as crappy as it ever was.
Your last book, The Underground Railroad, is being produced as a TV series on Amazon. Do you have any role in that?
No. You know, I had a few, you know, talks with Barry Jenkins, the director, but my attitude is I wrote it once. I wouldn't want to write it again. And then I have other things I want to work on, stuff like, you know, like new books like Nickel Boys. So it was, you know, it's really cool. They're starting to shoot in August next month. It'll be like 10 episodes, and I can't wait to see what they do with it.
Yeah. Are you nervous about seeing your work adapted like that?
Well, I think in general adaptations are terrible. So having someone like Barry Jenkins makes me feel very comfortable and excited. And, you know, it's one thing to write different scenes on the page, another thing to put them on screen. And so we've talked about some of his solutions for making it dynamic for the screen, and they're very smart. And it's stuff that I could never come up with. You know, it's a totally different medium. And so I'm pretty excited.
So you're not going to be drawn into writing screenplays next?
You know, periodically I'm like, I don't want to teach this semester. Can I write like a blockbuster screenplay? Then I'll get 20 pages in. I'm like, oh, this sucks. I'd rather write a novel. You know, it's hard work. I could do some things. Like, I can't write screenplays apparently. So I'll stay in my lane is my motto.
All right. Well, congratulations on the book. Colson Whitehead, it's been great to have you back. Thanks so much.
Thank you. See you next time.
Colson Whitehead's new novel is The Nickel Boys. Whitehead won the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize for his previous novel, The Underground Railroad. Coming up, we hear from Travis Reeder. He's a bioethicist who struggled with opioid dependence after a motorcycle accident shattered his foot. Now he's an advocate for opioid use reform. His new book is titled In Pain. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our next guest is a medical bioethicist who learned about opioid dependence the hard way. In 2015, Travis Reeder was in a motorcycle accident that crushed his left foot. The accident and six resulting surgeries left him in extraordinary pain, for which he was given large doses of opioids. The drugs got him through a terrifying period, but after 2 months of heavy medication, he wanted to taper off the opioids. In spite of the variety of doctors and nurses he'd worked with, he found it nearly impossible to get good advice about how to taper. The withdrawal period was awful, but with better advice, it wouldn't have been. In his own medical care, he witnessed what he describes as the incoherence of modern pain medicine. His new book, In Pain, draws on his insights as a patient, as well as his subsequent research into pain medicine to examine the larger problems and dilemmas surrounding prescription opioids and the larger opioid crisis. Reeder is a research scholar and the director of the Master of Bioethics degree program at the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. He spoke with Terry Gross.
Travis Reeder, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with the accident that led to your opioid dependence. What happened?
Well, it was Memorial Day weekend of 2015, and I had a lot to celebrate, so I'd gotten myself a shiny new motorcycle, went out for a ride, which I'm contractually obligated by my mother to say was just a bad idea. But I went out for a motorcycle ride, and I didn't make it three blocks that morning. I got struck on the left side of the motorcycle by a van who blew a stop sign. And my foot was crushed between the van and the bike. So the result of that accident is that I was put into what's called a limb salvage situation. And so I was at threat of having my left foot amputated.
You wanted opioids. You felt this pain was basically unsurvivable. So what were you given and what kind of doses were you given?
I desperately wanted these opioids. So when I'm in the hospital, the most potent medications that I get are intravenous. So I'm getting them through the IV. And this was sometimes morphine, sometimes fentanyl, and then sometimes hydromorphone, or what the brand name that people are familiar with is Dilaudid usually. So those I'm getting through IV every 4 hours or so. But in between those, I'm also getting oral opioids, so pills, and those started with immediate release oxycodone and then eventually built up into immediate release oxycodone. Plus, I would take OxyContin, which is the extended release version, twice a day. So this kind of builds up slowly over the first 6 weeks or so as my pain needs grow with more surgeries.
So at what point did you start to want to wean yourself from the opioids?
Well, for me, some of the experience of being on opioids was pretty unpleasant. So I think a lot of people know that opioids cause constipation, and that was really the only side effect that my clinicians were concerned with. They asked me every day about constipation and about my bowels. And so that was pretty unpleasant. And so about 2 months after the accident, I was home. We'd been home for a few weeks, just the slow kind of painful recovery. And I was wanting to be done with these medications because they were hard on me physically. And so I was kind of proud of myself that I slowly started extending the time between doses of my immediate release oxycodone. And so instead of taking them every 4 hours, which, you know, I'd spent weeks watching the clock and popping those pills as soon as possible because I was terrified of the pain. And now I'd say, well, you know, it's not too bad yet. Maybe I'll wait another half hour. Maybe I'll wait another half hour. And so I started to extend it to 5 and sometimes 5.5, sometimes 6 hours between doses. But that wasn't until about 2 months after the accident.
Which of your many doctors did you consult about how to do a serious taper to get off of the opioids?
I wouldn't call any of it a consultation. You know, you have all of these follow-up appointments with all of these different doctors after this sort of event. And so I went to see the orthopedic trauma surgeon. He's the guy who had pulled the bones in my foot back together, hoping to save the foot, right, in the immediate aftermath of the accident. Hadn't seen him in I don't know how long. And he kind of asked me the routine questions. We get to the point of how many pain meds are you on? We do the math and tell him. And he looks up real seriously and says, well, that's too much. You've been on these too long. That's a really high dose. It's time to get off them. But he did not give us a consultation on how to get off them. You know, it was a very, well, that's not my job. You know, I saw you for a week and a half after the accident to pull your foot back together. Who's been prescribing these meds? And we say, well, since we got home, it was the plastic surgeon. He said, okay, go talk to him. So we went and talked to the plastic surgeon. And, you know, by contrast, he was really quite unconcerned. He's like, yeah, sure. You know, if you're ready to get off the pills, we should do it. Why don't you just divide your daily dose into 4 and drop 1/4 each week, and then you'll be off the meds in a month. And so it wasn't very much of a consultation. He was just kind of unconcerned. He's like, yeah, this seems like a reasonable dose. So that's what he told us to do.
And you did that.
And we did that.
And
yeah,
what happened?
That was not good. So the upshot of all of this is that he didn't know what he was talking about. That wasn't his area of expertise. You know, he just tried to think of something that was reasonable, and he would eventually admit this, so this isn't too much editorializing. But we went home, and the next day we dropped the first dose, and it immediately sent me into withdrawal because these, especially immediate-release oxycodone, this has a very short half-life, and so within the first day, you get sick when you drop too aggressive a dose. So yeah, I went into withdrawal immediately, and it got worse over the first few days, and so we start to get really freaked out because I feel like I've got the worst flu I've ever had, multiplied by some order of magnitude. And I'm thinking, I have an entire month of this to get through. And so we get pretty freaked out almost immediately.
You tried to go to other doctors to get better advice about how to taper. And it was really hard to find somebody who would talk to you about this. Why was it so difficult?
I asked myself that question every day, every hour for a very long time. And once I kind of transitioned from being an opioid patient to being an opioid researcher, the answer I came to was something like, a lot of doctors don't know. So this is just a knowledge gap, right? So this is probably the best description of my plastic surgeon. He just had no idea how to do this. And that's understandable because doctors don't get a lot of pain education in medical school. It's not required. A bunch of them get zero. And on average, they only get a handful of hours. So there's a knowledge gap for sure. But we also spent the next couple weeks after I initially got sick from withdrawal calling every doctor we could imagine. And so think about, I had surgery at three different hospitals. I had five of those surgeries. I had, you know, a dozen or so surgeons, nurse practitioners, PAs writing these prescriptions. I had a pain management team. We called everybody and a bunch of them wouldn't even talk to me. And this includes the pain management team. They would not speak with me. And the message they sent through a nurse was, we prescribe opioids, but we don't help with tapering. And so I don't know if this is best described as a knowledge gap in those cases, because this is about them not wanting to deal with me. And so maybe this is best described as stigma, right? When somebody comes to you in opioid withdrawal, what do they look like? Well, they look like maybe they're struggling with addiction. They look like they're dealing with a drug that is causing havoc in our society. And that's a really scary thing for a physician to take on. So if they have any excuse at all for saying, not it, there's a good reason to take that.
Were you supposed to go to like a drug clinic?
Well, eventually that is where we ended up. So my initial prescribers, the docs who had written prescriptions, said, well, this is out of my league. Go talk to pain medicine. You know, as I said, the pain medicine doctors wouldn't even talk to us. We found another pain clinic where I'd never been seen, but we thought, well, we'd give them a try. And they said the same thing. You know, we prescribe opioids. We don't deal with tapering. And so finally, Sadia asked them, who does? Like, whose job is this? And the receptionist said, why don't you try addiction medicine? You know, why don't you go to a methadone clinic? Like, those are the people who deal with withdrawal and with tapering and getting people off these medications. So yeah, so the thought was, in this big game of hot potato, where the patient is the potato, everybody had a reason to send me to somebody else. And when we finally said, well, sure, I'll go to addiction medicine, like that isn't what I felt like I was dealing with, but sure, we call addiction clinics and they very nicely and very gently said, boy, you are not our job. We're dealing with people who might die from a heroin overdose, you know, anytime they get turned away. We're triaging here. You just took too many pain meds. Like, you just need your prescriber to get you off them.
So what did you do?
So we stuck it out. Every moment in those 4 weeks was the worst moment of my life. And every week we had to re-decide, are we going to stick to this plan? We kept calling doctors, including the prescribing physician. And he eventually said, look, this is getting scary. His symptoms are terrible. Why doesn't he go back onto the previous dose? And we would say, what then? And he'd say, well, try again later.
So the original plan was cutting your meds down by a quarter every week?
Yes, the plan that I've been given by the plastic surgeon to get off the medications in 4 weeks.
One of the painkillers that you were given when you were in the hospital was intravenous acetaminophen. And you thought that that was really surprisingly effective as a painkiller, but you were only given a few doses, even though you kind of begged for more because it was effective and not habit forming. So why couldn't you get more of it?
Yeah, this is such a wild story. I didn't know for a long time. And so all I had was this immediate experience where after that fifth surgery, when I was really behind the pain management team upped all of the doses of everything I was on, but then also gave me 3 doses over 24 hours of IV acetaminophen. And for me, the way I described it at the time, it was as good as morphine in the short term, but it didn't knock me out. It didn't sedate me. I didn't have to worry about my breathing. And so I really liked it for that reason, and I asked for more. And I remember one of the residents being kind of hesitant, you know, one of these young doctors in training, and kind of mumbling something about, I don't think you can have more because of your liver or something. I didn't question it. Months later, I'm an invited speaker at an anesthesiology conference, and I'm hanging out with some of the docs over a coffee break. And I'm telling them this story because I'm like, hey, I've got these, you know, really smart people. I'm going to pick their brains. And I get to the point where the resident mumbles this excuse to me and they all chuckle. And I look at them and I say, what? Is that not the reason? And I can tell in that moment that they all know something and that they all know that they all know. And one of them looks up at me and says, they're not giving it to you because it's too expensive. And my mind was blown. I was like, wait a minute. What do you mean it's too expensive? It's just Tylenol, right? He said, yeah, but the IV form is still on patent. And so once it goes off patent, it'll be standard of care because it works great. But, you know, for now, it's too expensive. So most of us have hospital orders not to use it. This blew my mind. And I eventually went and I did my homework. And I should say that the case isn't that clear. There's mixed reviews in the literature. Some people say it's just as good as morphine, which is what I said about my own experience. Some reviews say it's actually no better than oral Tylenol. So there's some mixed messages coming through in the literature, which justifies some of the hospital reactions. But it blew my mind because, you know, here I was telling them, if you give me Tylenol, I won't need as much morphine. And they couldn't give it to me. And that just kind of made me crazy.
So what strikes you as most crazy about that?
I think what it started for me was a dive down the rabbit hole of how does money play a role and how we treat pain and how we overutilize opioids for pain, right? Because what it made really clear is that opioids are dirt cheap because a bunch of them have been off patent for decades, and that these other sorts of therapies can be really expensive. And so, you know, you go out further into the future, into the less acute phase, you know, I would be in pain, well, for the rest of my life, but, you know, in more severe pain for months and years. And a lot of what I was supposed to do to help that pain was physical therapy, right? Well, physical therapy stopped getting coverage by my insurance when I turned over the new year and I had no longer hit my deductible. So it was too expensive. So I stopped because I was a, you know, relatively new faculty member. I couldn't afford it. And so I keep thinking, well, surely a bunch of other people would also struggle to pay for this, right? So there are all of these different methods for handling pain that they could be arrows in the quiver of medicine, but they're hard. They get covered less. They're expensive. And so what do we know about opioids? Well, they're incredibly cheap. So morphine is, you know, cents per dose, a couple cents per dose. And they are easy, right? You give them to the patient feels better immediately. You give pills to a patient who comes in complaining about pain, they leave happy. So this really led me to investigate this like deep system of perverse incentives that have pushed us towards just prescribing opioids instead of doing something more integrative and holistic.
One of the things you looked at was how military medicine handles pain. And understandably, the military has to deal with a lot of pain patients. So what are some of the things you learned by looking at the military?
Boy, this was interesting. Yeah, so I got introduced to a couple of these military docs through a friend of a friend. I went to this organization called DVCPM, which is an integrative pain medicine group for Uniformed Services University. And these guys are doing wild stuff. So one of the first things that they told me is that they go around training Army physicians to use acupuncture. And I was like, oh, well, that's kind of wild. I didn't know that acupuncture was taken, you know, that seriously, that the military would be into it. And then they're like, yeah, no, we use acupuncture on the battlefield.
On the battlefield?
On the battlefield,
wow.
Yeah. So they're training people with these ultra-mobile, sterile packs of what's called auricular acupuncture. So that auricular meaning going in the ear. So they're having folks, like, if you get injured on the battlefield, your medic, you know, has the shot of morphine. They're prepared with that. They have whatever triage kit that they have. But they also have this little pack with, I think it's 5 sterile little gold needles that they then inject into your ear. And the data they have on this is really pretty shocking. I mean, they tell stories about people for whom the acupuncture is so effective that they end up either using very little or even no opioids, you know, for some stretch of their treatment. That's kind of the most surprising thing that I learned. But they've also done a lot of work on using nerve blocks. So trying to turn a nerve off, essentially, you know, to your leg or to your arms. They have these mangled limb injuries, you know, body armor covers the torso, but you have arms and legs sticking out. So they have a lot of these mangled limb injuries. So they try to turn the nerves off to a mangled limb, and then they don't have to use any opioids. And this is really important, because if you're trying to fly somebody back from Iraq or Afghanistan, and they have to get all the way back to Walter Reed, how many hours are they going to be completely sedated with morphine before they get back? And that really starts a train leaving the station that is pretty hard to control. So now they have patients who come back with a nerve block who don't need any morphine for the flight. So they're doing really incredible things. And a big part of it was because as the military, they deal with more pain. And so they had this, you know, decade where they had to figure out, how in the world are we going to treat our soldiers without having a huge proportion of them coming out struggling with opioid use disorder, which is what they were facing. And so they're really focused on developing state-of-the-art opioid sparing treatments, and they're doing incredible work.
Travis Reeder, thank you so much for talking with us. This was great. Thank you.
Well, thank you for this. This has been a real thrill to chat with you.
Travis Reeder is the author of In Pain. He spoke with Terry Gross. Reeder is a research scholar and director of the Master of Bioethics degree program at the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer this week is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mooj Zaidi, Thea Challoner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.